Oh, as the Umbanlimbus cell wisely taught us that getting fat, you will not go far. Okay, so gluttony is interesting because of all the seven sins, gluttony seems to be the least discussed. There's not as much written about it, I would say. Not nearly as much, certainly, as lust, which, you know, we could give 10 classes on and just, you know, barely scratch the surface on it. But gluttony does not have as much as the others. So we'll see a few sources. I don't know if it's not viewed as complex. There may be a lot of gluttony is covered in, you know, we talk about greed. But gluttony usually, I think gluttony usually referred to food, right? Could mean... there's a laziness to gluttony, but usually refers to eating a lot of food. The truth is, as one could say, that this is not, this is a pretty big problem still in the Jewish community, I think. You know, it's not like the Jewish community is known for healthy, wonderfully healthy eating, you know. It's like whatever culture you're from, you know. I mean, there's ways to do it healthy, but it's not like it's inherently healthy.
It's good.
That's... <yeah. laughs> So let's see what we have here. So number one, this is from Vayikra 19, 1 and 2, which is Parshas Kedoshim. Hashem said to Moshe, saying, speak to the community of the people of Israel and tell them that they shall be holy because I, Hashem, your God, is holy. So... here we're told, Kedoshim to you, that you shall be holy. And a lot of the commentators try to figure out what is added here, right? I mean, this tells us we should be holy. Okay, great. That can mean anything. You know, how does one be holy? And if we already have an entire Torah teaching us mitzvah, then what are we going to do with this extra, you know, mitzvah, extra... responsibility to be holy? What does it fall under? What isn't that if we follow the mitzvot, then we'll be holy? So why do we need a special commandment to be holy? So the Ramban Nachmanides, who wrote, you know, lived in the 13th century, says there's an extra lesson here. So the issue here is that the Torah forbids illicit sexual behavior and non-kosher food, and allows sexual activity between man and wife, eating meat and drinking wine. So hedonist still has room to become obsessed with their desires, either with his wife or many wives, overindulge in wine and meat, and run after his desires in a number of the things that the Torah does not forbid. Okay, so the Torah forbids certain things, but within the prohibitions of the Torah, there's still plenty of room for a person to be a hedonist, right? Even if you follow all the rules of the Torah, it doesn't mean that you're suddenly going to become a perfect person just by following the laws, right? There has to be an added level of sensitivity on top of it that kind of is pervasive in your personality that you can, you know, learn and get better at because of the Torah. But the Torah in and of itself will not necessarily perfect you. So there's this extra level of being holy. That when in doubt, be holy. Right? Just because something is allowed doesn't mean you should do it. Right? By doing so, he can become a navel bershut Torah, a boar with the Torah's permission. So, look, you can eat, you know, red meat and get drunk every night. Nowhere in the Torah does it say, thou shalt not get drunk. Nowhere. Nowhere in the entire Torah. Well, is there, now it says they can't perform. You know, the Kohanim can't perform the service in the Beit HaMikdash if they're drunk. But no one in the Torah says, don't get drunk. No one in the Torah says, eat healthy. Now we have a mitzvah to be healthy, but it's not prescribed in any specific way. So, a person can be, in some ways, a bore of a person and still follow the Torah. So that's why we have this added, this is probably the source that most keenly looks at gluttony, and says, you know, this is really the anti-gluttony source, I would say, more than anything else. That being gluttonous is not a violation of the Torah. Really, it's, you know, you can follow the Torah to a T and still be gluttonous, and we see this all the time. Just hang out in Brooklyn for a little bit and see. Yeah. So that's not, this doesn't solve anything. The Torah doesn't stop one from doing that. There still has to be an extra level of sensitivity that a person has. Okay. But part of this, that, so this is, I think number three is a very important source. The Rambam Maimonides in the Laws of Yom Tov in the sixth chapter, 18th, it's called Halacha, discusses the mitzvah of Simcha Yom Tov, of celebrating, of happiness on Yom Tov, on the Jewish holidays. And so, there's a mitzvah to eat good food and drink wine on the holidays, right? And that's something everyone takes quite, you know, takes seriously, right? Well, that we'll all do. But he wants to point something out that he thinks is very important. When one eats and drinks in order to celebrate a Yom Tov, they're obligated to feed the stranger, the orphan, the widow, as well as all others in need. However, one who locks their doors and eats, drinks, and be merry with their own family, and don't feed the poor, that is not celebrating a Jewish holiday, but mere celebrating their own stomach. So, this to me speaks of gluttony to a certain extent. That even the Jewish holidays that have an element of gluttony within them, right? Shabbat, Yom Tov, where we're eating and we're drinking and we're having a grand old time. So while that's certainly part of the holiday, the purpose of a Jewish holiday is not just to eat, drink, and have a great time. That's a part of it, and to hang out with friends, that's a part of it. But if that's all it is, then that's not much of anything, right? That can't be the whole holiday. If that's all we have, then what do we really have? So he's saying that every Yom Tov, specifically, because Shabbos is different, there's not a mitzvah of being happy on Shabbos. There's a mitzvah of oneg, which is more of like a peace of mind on Shabbos. It's more of a relaxation, more of a calmer time. But a Yom Tov is a very lively time. We're supposed to celebrate, right? And celebrate means you're, you know, it's more festive. But if all it is festive for your own sake, then that's not really the purpose of the holiday as well. So this, I think, is, you know, again, using what would seem to be a gluttonous opportunity and trying to put it within context. Okay? So there's supposed to be a certain, again, a sensitivity to gluttony. Not that it's prohibited, but it can lead to a place that really makes you lose sight of what the Torah is about, what the holidays are about. You know, that's kind of some of the warnings here.
But yeah. Getting back to the thing of being, you have an obligation to be healthy.
Right.
I mean, that's a big obligation, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, you're obligated to, right, to be healthy.
Right, so being alcoholic is not being healthy, and being overweight and obese is not healthy.
No, you're right.
And you know, it's like something you do see, well, obviously it's a big problem now in the United States, the obesity problem.
Sure.
But you also, you know, see it a lot in the Jewish community too, where things mm-hmm. are, you know, everything is surrounded by food, and you know, there are a lot of overweight people.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. It's
I don't know how many alcoholics, but, you know.
No, it's definitely, I mean, even if it's not a health issue, per se.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But still, you can be gluttonous without being extremely unhealthy. Right? I mean, you can still be healthy, or somewhat healthy, but be gluttonous. I mean, I think in modern times, we could bring in all sorts of other vices into this mix, right? Smoking, marijuana, you know, whatever, take your pick. I mean, does that apply to gluttony? It's probably not usually lumped in, but to a certain extent there is an element of it.
How about in Yom Kippur, one of the al-chaits is not to be gluttonous, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, you're right. Good point.
Well, I see gluttony as like leading to like selfishness. Because when I think of a gluttonous person, I think naturally one thinks of someone who's overweight, but I think of someone who, like, takes more than he or she needs, like, on a plate. You know, like you think of like a buffet line. You know, they're piling on the food. Whether they're eating it or not, it's they want it because, you know, they want to make sure they have enough versus thinking of sharing and making sure everybody has enough.
Yeah. Right.
They are always, when I go to these weddings or things like that, I always notice people take way more on a buffet.
You don't go, just come to a kiddush, you don't go to a wedding.
Even a kiddush, how many times you see leftover? Some people even take, eat half as much.
Yeah. No, we had a problem a couple of weeks ago that people were taking too much and there wasn't enough food. But, this is a... No, you're right. Gluttony comes from a place of selfishness. I think that's what the Rambam's pointing out in source number 3, is that God didn't give us the holidays to be selfish and gluttonous, right? If your celebration doesn't involve helping others, then it's just a celebration. It's missing the heart, the spirit, the soul of what it's supposed to be about. And so for you to celebrate and literally just ignore those in need, either by inviting them over or by making sure they're being taken care of, then you've just really lost the whole point of what this is about. Right? And then it just becomes selfish. And that's not the point. That's not what we have these holidays. Yeah. Okay, let's get to lust. Where do we begin? Okay. How do we define lust?
Sort of an irrational wanting of something.
An irrational wanting of something.
It's something that you just want because you have to have it, whether there's any rhyme or reason for it.
Okay, so it's a overcoming of desire to have something. Okay.
How about lust for life? That's a positive thing.
Well, we'll talk about potential positives of lust. I mean, okay. I definitely focus more on the sexual side of it because I think of lust, I think of... because gluttony also is part of that. Greed is I have to have money, gluttony is I have to have food. So lust is typically within sexuality. So lust is I need to have sexual fulfillment, right? And it's we usually contrast lust with love. That it's not necessarily intertwined with any sort of meaningful relationship. Now, there can be lust within a meaningful relationship, right? So, you know, hopefully there is on some level, right? That there's an element of desire within the relationship, but the lust that we view as being negative is where it's not involved in any meaningful relationship. It's just the lust in and of itself for its own purpose. Okay. There's a lot of very interesting sources. Let's delve right into it. I can't say it better than the sources themselves. Okay, number one. This is from the Talmud Sanhedrin 107 Daf Kuzayin. It happened, this is the first we're going to quote, a verse from the second book of Samuel, 11th chapter, second pasuk, second verse. It happened towards evening that David arose from bed and strolled on the roof of the king's house. From atop the roof, he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. Right, this is Bathsheba. Okay, so obviously this leads to this moral. What King David is taken to task for more than anything is he becomes so infatuated with Bathsheba that he wants her for himself. Only problem is she's already married. So as king, he has the authority to send people to war. So he sends her husband to their front lines, letting things take care of itself, and then he can marry her. So even though technically he followed the letter of the law, clearly this was not something he should have done. Okay. So, but this is how it starts. How does the whole problem start? It starts by an accident, right? He went to he wakes up in the morning, he goes onto the roof, he looks out, and he sees a woman bathing, and she's very beautiful. But he didn't, it doesn't seem like that was his intention, he just, you know, he's in this palace, he's got a...
I don't know.
You don't know, he's... Okay. So...
He didn't go blind.
What?
He didn't go blind.
Fair enough. So, Rabbi Judah said, David changed the nature of his sexual behavior, lying with his wife during the day instead of at night. As Rashi adds here in the italics, figuring this way, he'd satiate his sexual desire early so it wouldn't interfere with his daily activities. But he forgot a simple law. If you attempt to feed your sexual desires, they become hungrier. If you starve them, they cease to become hungry. Okay, this is a loaded statement here. So, when it comes to David, he is described as someone who had intense sexual desires. Okay? Which is usually intertwined with certainly with men that are powerful, strong, warriors, that type of thing. So usually the two are intertwined, and we'll see a little bit more of that connection later on. So it seemed like this was bothering him. It was getting in his way, right? And there are people throughout history who've looked at sexuality in some ways, especially for men, sexuality can become a nuisance, right? Because it just keeps gnawing at you. And there's, you know, what do you do with that? What do you do with that impulse when it's, you know, when it's prevalent and common, you know, and it keeps coming back? So King David had a plan. He figured if he lied with his wife in the morning, that would take care of that. He'd go on with his day. It wouldn't be that desire wouldn't be gnawing at him throughout the day, so it wouldn't distract him, it wouldn't pull him in different directions. He'd be able to focus better. So that was his plan. Makes sense, right? You have breakfast in the morning, so you won't be hungry, you know. So, makes sense. So I figured that, yeah, this should apply just as well. But there's one simple law, and this is something that we see throughout rabbinic writing from this point forward, that when it talks about sexuality, this is kind of the psychological law of sexuality. That if you attempt to feed your sexual desires, they become hungrier. That sex does not work the same way as food. When you eat, you become less hungry, but people can become obsessed or addicted to sex. And that the more a person engages in it, instead of them, it's something that never gets fulfilled. It's a desire that never gets fulfilled. And obviously you can't, you know, you never crush it, never remove it from you. But when you feed it, it becomes hungrier. And if you starve it, meaning if you're able to control it, then it ceases to become hungry. So the way to combat that impulse is not to give into it and to get rid of it, quote unquote, and then now it's you know, not have to worry about it anymore. Like it's hunger. The opposite. Sorry?
Like hunger.
Right. So here's interesting lesson number one. When it comes to lust, it's a very unique impulse. Right? The way the Talmud describes it, it's a very unique impulse. It has its own rules. And the strength of it and the power of it, which we'll get into even more, is really, there's nothing else that's compared to it. We quoted the source a little while, you know, a few weeks ago. The only other desire that's ever really compared to sexuality was the desire for idol worship, you know, in the times of the First Temple and before, which then the Jewish people, times of Ezra, asked Hashem to remove from them, and it has been removed from our systems. So right now, we don't have anything that compares to this. There's nothing else that compares to this desire. Its intensity and its kind of overwhelming nature. Definitely different for men and for women, which we'll get into a little bit as well. But when it comes to King David, kind of this male warrior, you know, alpha male type, who really was trying to, seems like his intentions were good, he really wanted to control this animal within him. That was just becoming too much, you know, becoming too much for him to handle. That led to the problem with Bathsheba, because since he lied with his wife in the morning, instead of removing this from his head, he became
more obsessed
with it. And so when he saw her, instead of being able to look away and just ignore it, it became something that really gnawed at him even more, right? It became, and that, and the fact that he forgot this simple law, as the Talmud describes it, that's what led to the story of Dovid Bat Sheva. So a very interesting little insight to the story. Okay, number two. Who wants to read number two? This is pretty long, so maybe we'll break it up. There's three different paragraphs here. That three different little stories. Okay.
Certain captured women were brought to Nahar Dea.
Nahar Dea. That was one of the two major cities in Babylonia. Okay.
They took him up to the second story of Rab of Amram the pious and removed the ladder from before them. As one of the redeemed women passed by the hatch, a light shone through the hatch, showing her face. Rav Amram took a ladder so heavy that 10 men would not be able to lift, and proceeded to climb the ladder. When he reached the middle of the ladder, he spread his feet apart to steady himself and shouted, "Fire in the house of Amram!" The rabbis came running and saw him in the compromised position. They said to him, "You have put us to shame." He replied to them, "Better that you be shamed in the house of Amram in this world, and you not be ashamed in the world to come." Rav Amram adjured Yetzirah to leave him, and it issued from him in the form of a fiery column. Rav Amram said to the Yetzirah, "Observe, you are fire, and I am flesh, yet I am stronger than you."
Okay. Loaded story number two. So we have this character, it was a real person, Rav Amram, and he's known as Rav Amram HaChassid, the pious, which is a very rare moniker that someone was given, that obviously they'd shown tremendous piety and self-control. So these women were held in second story, like a loft, basically. And he saw one of them, was so attracted to her that he grabs this very heavy ladder and starts climbing up to see her, to, you know, whatever his plan is. Halfway up, he stops himself and screams, "Fire in the house of Amram," forcing people to come in, you know, think there's a fire. So why does he do that? Why doesn't he just climb back down?
Because he doesn't think he can.
Right, so he doesn't trust himself.
Yeah.
Right. So here you have rule number two when it comes to sexuality. Number one is what the law we saw in the first source. Law number two is no one should trust themselves when it comes to sexuality. No one should trust themselves. And we see this over and over, and we'll see a few more sources as well, that when it comes to sexuality, there's no exceptions to the rules. The rules that apply to a simple person apply just as much to a pious person. So we don't say, for example, so that there's a prohibition of a man and woman who cannot be married from being in a room together by themselves, if no one else is around and no one else can come in. Right? There's a lot of different rules, you know, when it can happen, when it can't. But certainly, let's say it's 10 o'clock at night, a man should not be in the apartment of someone else's wife. Just the two of them, husband's not there, right? And there's no exception to the rule of, well, if he's a great rabbi, then it's okay. No such rule, no such exception. If anything, it's the great rabbis who probably even more careful about this than anybody else, and should be and have to be. So why is that? Why don't we say, well, the great rabbi's not going to do anything, right? He's so pious, he's so righteous, that he would never think of such a thing. A thought would never enter his mind. Because when it comes to sexuality, no one should trust themselves. Right? It's too powerful. The way we control sexuality is not by conquering it. It's by establishing limits and boundaries. Because we can't trust ourselves. Right? And that's laid out in this story. That Rav Amram realized that this was the case. And if he already started climbing up that ladder, even if he climbed back down, so I'll climb back up in a minute, right? I mean, it's not going to solve anything. He had to shame himself in order to pull himself away, right? That a person should never trust themselves. There's even a term used in the Talmud of "ain apotropos l'arayos," that there's no one can be their own, their own watchdog when it comes to sexuality. No one can be trusted. Everyone has to avoid the situation, right? You don't go. You don't put yourself in the situation, assuming I'll be okay. So this applies to each and every person. There's no exceptions whatsoever. So here we have this Rav Amram. This story shows us, and this story is recorded in Talmud forever. That this is almost becomes the story he's known for. But I love the end of it. The lesson that he learns from it. As he yells at the Yetzirah, he yells at the evil inclination, right? So you're fire and I'm flesh. You should be stronger than me. Fire burns flesh, right? This Yetzirah is pure energy, pure impulse. And it's the strongest impulse that a person can have. And Rav Amram, when he is in this state where he's climbing up the ladder, he is in this, he's completely obsessed by it, where he's not thinking of anything else. It's as intense within him then as anyone, as it could be in anyone, at any time. And the fact that he's able to stop himself and avoid going any further, that is the accomplishment. That's the accomplishment, right? It's not something that you remove from your system. It's not something that, certain people just don't have because they've I think the Catholic Church has proven over and over again that as much as you want to convince yourself that righteous people don't think that way, don't have such desires, that doesn't lead anywhere good. It's a very dangerous, dangerous thing to do. It's a very dangerous way to think because it leads to all the things it has led to, right? It's a really dangerous
bad.
Way to think. What?
Really bad.
Really, really, really bad. And but it comes from this fallacy. It comes from a fallacy that it's possible for someone to do that. That's possible for someone to control themselves in this area without any sort of outlet. It's impossible.
Isn't that why they make you a saint?
Yeah, and if we knew what all the saints did, I'm sure that would be interesting too. But we'll see. That's not even our goal. That's not our goal in any way, right? That's not the Torah's goal to create people who could claim to do something like that, right? The story of Rav Amram is in many ways. That's the story that represents the Jewish perspective on how to conquer the impulse of sexuality. He didn't knock it out of his system. He didn't remove it from him, so he never had. He, in his, when he was just as, as righteous as anyone of his generation, he couldn't. And when he was in a situation where he had to pull away, he couldn't trust himself to do it on his own. He had to bring other people in to prevent him from doing it. And he wasn't laughed. I mean, they were upset at him. The people were upset at him. You put us to shame, and he answers them right back. Well, I'm sorry. Better to be shamed in this world than to be shamed in the world to come. This is what I need to do to stop. And I embarrass myself more than I embarrass anybody else. But that's what it took, and that's what he did. And the willingness to put himself through that. To embarrass himself, to be caught red-handed, and to call attention to himself, to in order to stop him from doing that. That is the, to have to be that intellectually honest, and to be that sincere in your devotion to do the right thing. That is the most powerful thing of all. Because if anything, people spend their time trying to avoid being caught doing things that they don't want to be caught doing. And here he is intentionally calling attention to it. And that is the accomplishment. Are any questions on that story? Okay. Normally, the next one, Rabbi Meir.
Rabbi Meir was accustomed to scoff at sinners, saying they were just weak and could conquer their Yetzer Hara if they really wanted to. One day, the Yetzer Hara appeared to him disguised as a woman on the far side of the river. There was no ferry boat, so he grasped onto a rope and proceeded to cross. When he reached the middle of the rope, the Yetzer Hara released him from its grip. It said to Rabbi Meir, "Had it not been proclaimed in heaven, be cautious of Rabbi Meir and his Torah learning, I would have made your life worth 2 ma'ah."
Okay, read the next story because it's connected.
Rabbi Akiva was accustomed to scoff at sinners. One day he appeared to
Rabbi... The Yetzer Hara, yeah.
Appeared to Rabbi Akiva as a woman perched atop a palm tree. And so he held on to the palm tree and began to ascend it. When he reached the middle of the tree, the Yetzer Hara released him and said, "Had it not been proclaimed in heaven, be cautious of Rabbi Akiva and his Torah learning, I would have made your life worth 2 ma'ah."
All right, what do you need the lesson is here? Why does the Yetzer Hara do this to them?
Testing them. To see if their Torah learning has any influence on them.
It seems like they failed, both of them, miserably.
Yeah, they did.
So did they fail?
Yes.
Well,
I think there's another way of looking at it.
They didn't fail, they attempted.
No, I'm saying they attempted to fail. Well, okay. What is the Yetzer Hara doing here?
It's testing them.
Testing.
I think he's trying to conquer them, because they are so righteous and they're so it's almost like the story of like Job, like why Job, right? Well, because Job was never gonna like curse Hashem. You know, it's like the same thing. The Yetzer Hara wants the most righteous, the most Torah learned, to almost say, I got your best ones.
So what does it mean that the Yetzer Hara released him from its grip? What did the Yetzer Hara do?
Made him weak, which is made him drunk.
Well, maybe in the middle of the river, the Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Meir stopped themselves, meaning they lost grasp of the Yetzer Hara, and they stopped themselves and said, I'm not going towards the Yetzer Hara.
But the way it's described, it seems that the Yetzer Hara
was in control.
It only stops because Hashem said, don't do this. Really don't do it. You proved your point already.
Right.
Sorry?
He released him.
Really, right. So,
right.
The way I understand this, and tell me if you see it, you know, differently, is that I look at it like the thermostat's on 68 degrees, right? That's a comfortable level. That's a good balance. Okay? The Yetzer Hara turns up the heat to 95, right? Where it's no longer a fair game anymore. It's no longer a fair game, right? It's the Yetzer Hara on steroids. Okay? It's not fair anymore. Meaning, we're created with an equilibrium. We have a desire to sin, we have a desire and an ability and intellectual capacity to do good. And the two have to have somewhat of an equal playing field for it to be a fair fight. But if our Yetzer Hara meter was amped up to a level that we don't even know what to do with it anymore, so then maybe even, you know, unwittingly, it's almost like they're not. It's almost like they're being controlled by the Yetzer Hara at this point. It's like the free will is being removed from them. Intentionally, the Yetzer Hara is amped up to 95 degrees, where no person could withstand it. Right? They've lost that equilibrium. They no longer. It's almost like they're not even human to a certain extent, because they're in this trance. Right? They don't even know what they're doing. They're stopped in the middle, and they have to look up and see what's going on. And they realize that they're, you know, it's almost like they've been hypnotized during this whole thing. I think the lesson is to teach them, look, you guys have kind of figured out how to handle your Yetzer Haras. Other people have not. And it's not that they're weak, it's that you're very strong. Right? So stop. I mean, the whole point here is stop laughing at these people. Don't laugh at them, help them. Right? Try to teach them ways to make themselves better, to have more self-control. But if all you do is they laughed at them because they couldn't relate to them. They couldn't see how anyone could act this way. So the Yetzer Hara shows, I can make anyone act this way. I can make you act this way. I can make you act worse than anybody. Because you're only... Yeah, I'm saying, because you're only the way you are because, yes, you've accomplished, you know, you've worked on yourself, you've worked on your character. But it's only because the Yetzer Hara has given you this equilibrium. But once you changed the dynamics, so for the regular people, maybe it's not this intense, But it's very intense, and they're doing the best they can, but they're not as refined as you are. So work, help them, don't laugh at them. I think that's to me, that's the lesson here.
Yeah.
So it's not really an indictment of Rabbi Meir or Rabbi Akiva. I think they're being used as pawns in this lesson. I think they're being taught a lesson. And I think the point is, be cautious of Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Akiva, that they're Torah learning, and say, look, Yitzhar, you've proven your point, but if you let them go any further, their reputations will be so ruined that all they've accomplished in their lives will be, will be rendered meaningless. Nobody will respect them anymore, right? That's why they're taken to a point, and then they sort of stop because it's not okay. You've proven your point, but the point is that the Yetzer Hara we have it for an equilibrium. We can conquer it, but there could be a point that we couldn't conquer it, and there are points in our life when a specific situation arises. When you're in the middle of it, you can't conquer it. It's extremely, extremely difficult to conquer it. And people go through these periods when at certain points they can't conquer it anymore. Okay. Source 3. For sexual matters, the Sefer Achinuch, which is it's a book that goes through the 613 mitzvot. So, and he gives explanations for them. So, source number 3, for sexual matters are very difficult and desires are very strong. Therefore, a person should always be extremely careful. There is a rule from the Torah that a person shouldn't be alone in a room with someone who they are prohibited to marry. Right? And that's what we're saying, that there's no one can be trusted. No one should think that they've conquered this. Because once you think that way, you're now susceptible to it. We can go through pick your celebrity, your Tiger Woods, your Arnold Schwarzenegger, or whoever you want to pick, whoever is the most current one in this situation, right?
We could like you said, they're like King David; they're men of power,
right? So
you usually see that men of power.
Elsewhere, the Talmud says that actually the two are interrelated. That especially for men, that sexual desire is in many ways the aggressiveness that's tied into aggressiveness. Mm-hmm. The two are interrelated. If a man is castrated, he loses a lot of that aggressiveness, that desire, that ambition. So the two are interrelated. And that's why it's so powerful, because it's the strongest drive. It's what drives men to do crazy things and to go to war and do all sorts of crazy things, but it's the raw energy. It's the raw energy that pushes. For women, we see that the way it's described, it's much more of a we could use all sorts of cliches, but for women, it's more described as the closeness, right? There's a lust aspect to it, but the sexuality is about closeness. For men, it's just a totally different thing. It's about for men, it's part of love, but separate from love. For women, it's intertwined with love in a much more meaningful way. So for men, it just becomes this overwhelming drive that becomes, something they've got to figure out.
It's chilly.
Oh. Figure out how to handle their entire lives. And so there's many, many sources, and we see, that's usually what. So that's usually when men get in trouble, that's usually what's going on. And again, pick your latest, your David Letterman, your Ben Roethlisberger, whoever else you want. There's no end in sight.
Strauss-Kahn,
Charlie Sheen, I don't know, whoever you want. And wait till next week, there'll be another one. So that's not going away. So that's the challenge that men have more than women in that sense. But the flip side is this. The flip side of lust is that we do not want to remove lust. And like we said, the story in the Talmud of when they dive in first for the desire for idol worship to be removed from their systems, and it was. And then they dive into Hashem that the desire for sexuality should be removed from their systems, and it was as well. And they realized that wasn't going to work. Mm-hmm. Because lust, for all of its danger, is one of the driving forces through maintaining our population. Right? I like to look at it this way. There's two driving forces that drive the propagation of our species. It's maternal instinct and lust. Between the two, we're okay. But we're gonna keep having kids. But it's seen as very, very important that that there is an element of sexual excitement in a relationship. So source number four is kind of a weird source, but it's a very important source. Who wants to read number four?
Rav Kahana snuck under the bed of his teacher when he was not around. He remained under the bed while his teacher was intimate with his wife. Afterwards, his teacher realized what happened and reprimanded Rav Kahana. He responded, "It is also Torah and I must learn it."
Oh, God. So it's a little weird.
Is that how they taught sex education in those days?
No, Rav Kahana reprimands. I'm sorry, it was his teacher. Yeah. His teacher reprimands him that, you know, there's other ways of learning this, but he doesn't. It's not the intention that's the problem. It's the execution that's the problem, right? But it seems like he's very sincere, right? He seems like almost innocent and sincere. Like, it's also Torah and I must learn it, right? I need to learn what I need to do and how am I supposed to know? I don't know. I've never, single guy.
I guess nobody told him anything.
No, right? No, he didn't have the internet, so how's he supposed to know anything?
He's had the father.
What? I don't know. I don't know what his father taught him. Who knows? Yeah. You know, and every parent likes to talk about the stuff with his kids. So the message is true. It is also Torah and I must learn it. That's true. That's true. Again, that's not the way to do it. So, there and the way the story is told in the Talmud, that Rav Kahana's teacher doesn't combat that, doesn't say, no, you're wrong. He agrees with that point, he just disagrees with his methodology. So it's also Torah and I must learn it is important because the Torah actually thinks it's very important that a man and woman have a mutual fulfilling sexual relationship. That's a very important part of a marriage and essential for the couple to have a happy marriage. So in that sense, we embrace lust, but lust within the context, right? So I don't know if it's lust, I don't know if there's a different word for it, but there has to be that element of excitement in a marriage, and that's what the mikvah is for, to force separation between the couple, so that when you're apart for a little bit of time, it builds up anticipation and desire, so that when the couple comes back together, there's that excitement. But both parties need that, you know? Men need that, and women need that. Men need that, you know, men want to desire the woman, and the woman wants to be desired by the man, right? That's the whole thing. You can talk about your former industry, the cosmetics industry. Mm-hmm. How big of an industry is that today?
Billions of dollars.
Billions of dollars.
Yeah.
What?
Plastic.
Plastic surgery, yeah. Right? And what percentage of cosmetics is female-driven?
Oh, I don't know the percentage, but it's majority.
Right, the vast majority.
Yeah, there's a very, very small percentage that is men. Bond.
Right, it's not.
It's not for men.
you're not making any money that way.
You mean we don't put on lipstick?
So mm-hmm. Right. So for women, lust is important, but not really so much for themselves, but to be an object of someone's desire is very important for women. For women's self-esteem, for her interest in a relationship, it becomes a very important part of what the relationship's about. And there's certain exceptions that are given to women, to married women, especially when they first get married. Like, they're allowed to wash their face in Yom Kippur the first 30 days that they're married, even though you're not allowed to wash your face, because we realize it's important for her psychologically to look good for her new husband. You know, things like that. So, and that's really where the laws of tzniut come about, of dressing modestly. The reason that women have a mitzvah to dress modestly, men don't, is because women have a yitzhahara, they have a desire to be desired, to be wanted, to be an object of affection. And so that can, left unchecked, a woman could go to any, you know, any step to do that, right? There has to be some sort of, we don't want that to go too far. Yeah.
But if the woman don't want to be deserved.
Right.
How in the Torah I can find that, like a channel to close this? I don't want to be deserved. How in
you
the
don't
Torah,
be,
how
mean,
can I
you,
find
you, it? You don't be desired by everybody?
No.
I mean, you don't be desired by anybody or
no.
by everybody?
Everybody.
Right, well,
that's
what modesty is about. That if a woman dresses modestly, it removes a lot of the sexuality from the encounter.
How can I remove from the Torah? How can I stop it? Like, he didn't climb. He stopped it in the middle of the letter.
Right.
So how in the Torah I can find something to don't have anymore?
To anymore any desire?
Yeah, like he found something to stop it. Like he said to the fire and the other one.
Right.
In the Torah have some part.
So how to stop desiring? I mean, how to stop
for a woman?
Yeah.
For men or for women?
For a woman.
To stop desiring.
For a man.
Well, I think the same. I think what it comes down to is controlling situations and encounters. It's not something you can remove from your psyche, right? It doesn't just like disappear. It's controlling the situations that you don't put yourself in situations where, you know, you or get together with people that are going to go down a path, you know. So that's where the control comes in.
You know, I think though, a lot of women dress and look good for other women, and not for men.
Exactly,
you know
this point. It's like, for a woman.
I mean,
it's
I don't think men
a...
like notice, you know, what kind of dress you're wearing, or if it matches, or it's the latest style, or if your hair is like perfectly colored, or if your makeup is on fine. They do it so other women notice it. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And not women being jealous.
Well,
no, it's just.
It's tough to explain.
Yeah,
but it's like,
you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like,
but
it's exactly this what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I don't dress for a man. I dress for me or for other women. I don't want to the men's coming to me. So how can I stop it?
Stop men from coming on to
you? Yeah, because it's not something I want to. I just want
to. And the point is that
why I need to look like a garbage for make sure nobody will see me? I need to throw the garbage every day on me. So I want to close. How can I close this?
I think with some men, it's simply that you're a woman. No.
If I throw the garbage, for sure nobody's in. No.
You have to try.
I think men do notice.
I will try.
They dress well, they do notice. They may not notice the way you notice,
or
but they
the way
do
other
notice.
Women notice.
Yeah.
Well, I think you're right. Well, women judge each other based on how they dress and how they look.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
that becomes a part of a woman's identity.
But
her style is a big part of her identity.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Right. For men, it's somewhat a part of their identity, but not nearly as much.
Right.
Right?
But that's what I mean.
But the root source of it, right? For example, the Talmud says that that when Adam and Eve had their blessing and their curses, there was a blessing interwoven into the curse. Okay? So for Chava, for woman, her curse was pain in childbirth, and her blessing was that men would chase after her. That's the way it's written. Is that her blessing is that, try as she might, men will always chase after women, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a certain power that gives women. There's a very real power that gives women. And that, in some ways, is the most powerful collective powers that women have.
Mm-hmm.
Is the ability to control men, and often using sexuality as one of the main means of doing that.
Yeah, I understand that. I understand that. That's part of it too.
So, but you're right. I'm saying it's all intertwined. Meaning, how do men judge other men? Right? Often by accomplishment.
Right.
Right? By success and accomplishment. Now, men are trying to impress other men, for sure.
Right.
But ultimately, a man also knows that to attract a woman, they need to be successful.
No, but it's in a different way. Like, men will have a better car, a better watch. A woman, it's about clothes. It's about how she dresses.
No, that's what I'm saying. Men and women are simultaneously impressing men and women.
Yeah.
Because men are impressed by James Bond, and women are impressed by the women, right? Yeah. When men used to be men and women used to be women, right? I just remember.
So it's a little bit of both.
It's a little bit of both. So I think it's happened simultaneously, but meaning men judge other men based on success, partly because they know that women value sex within men, success within men. Mm-hmm. And women view other women and judge them based on looks and how they dress, partly because they know that overall, that's how, you know. I'll put it this way. If you want to get a woman upset, if a man says to a woman, boy, I think that woman's beautiful, and that and the woman disagrees, boy, that just became a whole conversation. You like that? You think she's pretty? Yeah, she's pretty. How do you think she's pretty? Have you seen her? Oh my, I mean, that just became a whole thing, right?
So you know what you do. Never
see
that.
No, the worst part is when they ask you, do you think she's pretty? Oh, I'm not answering that question. I have no idea. I have no idea. I don't even know how to judge such things. I don't know, man.
What woman?
Ask somebody else. I have no idea. Yeah. So, right? There's no good answer to that question, right?
So there's a fine, there's actually like a fine line, whereas you want as a person to look good, but in Judaism, you
want
to have a little bit of
sneeze. Right. I mean, right. I didn't plan this being a sneeze class, but yeah, that's the idea. Is that right for women? There's and for men too, but certainly for women, looking good is certainly fine.
It's like when I was in college and we were hitchhiking around Europe and whatever. It's like you don't stand. You know, you don't go into the middle of the Arab souk in short shorts and tank top. You know. Like you're asking for trouble.
Well, I heard a great line. You can be attractive, just not attracting. You know, there's like a difference. There's nothing wrong with looking, being attractive.
Right.
I mean, you can't help that God made you into a very beautiful woman. You can be attractive, just don't be attracting.
But I think women know there's a line.
Don't want to.
I think women know with other women when a woman's trying a little too hard to attract attention through her looks. I think that's that comes out. I think that's and it's pretty obvious to everybody. But I think other women pick it up probably quicker than a man would.
And her behavior, too.
Right, exactly. Right. And often it's about attracting attention. That's usually what it's, the main source of it is. So if your goal is to attract attention, that's the problem.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, let's just finish up these sources. And take this, and then we'll finish up with our last clip. Okay. This is from the Ramban. The Igaret HaKodesh, which means like the holy letter. This is the letter he writes to his son. So he writes, know that the act of union is a holy and pure manner. When carried out in the proper manner, at the proper time, and with the proper intentions, a person should not think that there's anything degrading or unbecoming in the act of union, God forbid. Right? This is that Judaism believes very strongly in a strong sexual relationship between a husband and a wife. And that's very important. And it's not something we have to, you know. It's not a bidyevet. It's not something we do only because, well, what choice do we have? It's actually it's an important mitzvah. We should embrace it. It should be embraced. It's not something that should be shunned. It's not a necessary evil. It is in and of itself. If this is how God creates the world for us to procreate, then it can't be a bad thing. It's not inherently a bad thing. It just needs perspective. And there's an interesting way of looking at it. Source number 6. There should not be a Kadesh among the daughters of Israel. There should not be a Kadesh among the sons of Israel. So a Kadesh is a prostitute. And a Kadesh is like a gigolo. If that word is still used today. I don't know.
How did they get Kadesh?
Where's the
root
of that word?
So, right. So the root is Kadosh. The root is holy.
Wow.
So the root of prostitute, the root is for the root that's holy. So why is that? The Ramban writes, number 7, because one who separates themselves from holiness is referred to as a kadesha. That sexuality,
separation, not holy.
Well, no, but sexuality has the strongest potential to be used in the holiest of ways and the unholiest of ways, right? It's to get the strongest, what's the word? The strongest spectrum, right? The largest spectrum. Some things, okay, so you can make them somewhat holy. I mean, sexuality, you're literally talking about the biggest mitzvah that we have, right? And right, and a strong marriage, which is one of the most important ideals that we have, and at the same time, it can be the most destructive thing. So it's really, you know, there's a fine line between the two, but it's all intertwined. It's the good and the bad is all interwoven.